Hello, Thinking Fellows listeners. This is Caleb Keith, and today is Giving Tuesday. Giving Tuesday, if you don't know, is a day set apart to help support and promote nonprofit organizations. 1517 has used Giving Tuesday in the past, and we are using it this year to kick off our end-of-year giving campaigns. Today, we have a $200,000 donation goal on Giving Tuesday. We have several donors who have kindly offered to match gifts up to the first $100,000. So if you give today, every dollar is essentially $2 up until that first $100,000 that we received today. If the Thinking Fellows and the 1517 Podcast Network have been impactful to you, I encourage you to go to our homepage today, which has been taken over by our Giving Tuesday campaign, and click the links there to support our efforts today and the efforts of the Podcast Network for the remainder of this year and going into 2022. There's a couple of remarkable things about the 1517 Podcast Network. The first is that we have a unified goal to proclaim Christ crucified and raised for the forgiveness of sins and your freedom on every single one of our shows. Not every show is proclamation or sermons, but the heart and the goal of those shows is to remind people of that forgiveness and that death and resurrection for you. The other unique elements of our shows are the content is free and it's also ad-free. And the way we've been able to maintain an entire podcast network of ad-free shows that continues to expand its scope and the level of content that it produces, as well as market into broader audiences, is by the generous support of donors like you. Again, if you have been impacted by the Thinking Fellows or one of our shows, today is a great day to help us kick off fundraising for the end of the year and the beginning of next year as we continue to try to broaden our podcast network and particularly get this message out to a larger audience. We thank you for your support and your consideration, and I hope you enjoy this episode of the Thinking Fellows. Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I am joined by Drs. Adam Francisco and my father, Scott Keith, to discuss C.S. Lewis and the Inklings. This is kind of a transitionary episode for us. We talked about the overview of C.S. Lewis' life in the first episode that we did in this series. Then last episode, we tried to move into the impact and scope of his works, and towards the end, we made a suggested sort of reading list for those who are maybe only familiar with the most popular of his works. And today we decided we're going to define an inkling so that we can then sort of move on to J.R.R. Tolkien. The Thinking Fellows podcast is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. to see all the shows there. And if you are interested in this topic, not only do we have this podcast, but we have several blogs that revolve around the Inklings on the 1517 website. So you can type in Inklings, you can type in C.S. Lewis or Tolkien in the search bar there, and you will find some things. I think we have probably over 15 different articles there.
Well, I guess, yeah, at least that much. Sam Schulteis writes a lot about the Inklings.
Right. So he's contributed quite a bit there on that topic. And, Dad, in Where Two or Three Are Gathered, there is a chapter, right, on the Inklings?
Correct. Yep.
So we have a book with at least one chapter on the subject as well.
I think I wrote at least one blog that went on 1517. I think it's called Dangerous Friendships.
So this is a topic that we're familiar with, that we've covered, but can help us get into a topic that we've never covered, which we've never done an episode on Tolkien himself here. But for, the first sort of thing of business is to define an inkling. It's a very funny word, isn't it? Inkling. It sounds like somebody who spills a lot of ink. But who were the Inklings? Why are they notable? Why is it worth talking about? Why are people probably familiar with this? And why such a funny name?
Adam.
I think you should define inkling because you're the guy who's written on it.
It's a kind of a loose literary society in Oxford, based around C.S. Lewis was, I think, the primary sort of inkling that brought the other members of the group together. If I remember correctly, it was originally sort of a student literary society. And once the student literary society, I think, disbanded sometime in the 30s, this group of mostly Oxford dons, professors, took over the name for their meetings. Some of the notable people in the group would have been C.S. Lewis, his brother Warney, J.R.R. Tolkien, Owen Barfield, Charles Williams. Not all of them were professors at Oxford. Several of them were. Most of them were sort of, you might say, characters around Oxford, even if they weren't professors, and still did some lecturing and that type of thing. And they'd get together twice a week. I might get my Tuesdays and Thursdays messed up here, but I think it was Thursday morning at the Eagle and Child, which is a pub in Oxford. Adam, I recently heard that it's been sold and they're turning it into a hotel.
No.
Yeah.
like a C.S. Lewis themed motel or just a motel?
I thought that's a really weird missed opportunity if you do that or kind of. So maybe they'll keep the pub downstairs, maybe the whole building, because it's in a building where basically the pub is the ground floor and there's stuff above it. But maybe it's the above it that'll be the hotel and the pub will still be downstairs. But anyway, they met at this pub and they would drink beer and have British food and argue about things.
British food.
mash, fish and
like
chips.
I said, I may be getting my Tuesdays and Thursdays mixed up. And then I think it was Tuesday night they would meet over at Magdalen College, where Lewis was a tutor. And when you get to that, some other situations in the States, when you get to be a don at an Oxford college, they actually give you like a suite of rooms. I think, there's an office, there's a sitting room to have tutorials. I think there may even be like a sleeping area. They'd meet there, and that's where sort of they would read to one another what they were working on. I mean, there's accounts of Lewis reading to the group Screwtape letters and while it was in its drafts, and even some of the drafts of the Chronicles of Narnia. Definitely the first draft of Out of the Silent Planet. He got a lot of criticism on that. There's accounts of both J.R.R. Tolkien and later Christopher Tolkien reading chapters of The Lord of the Rings in this group.
Yeah, so they read The Hobbit, and then before he had it titled The Lord of the Rings, he would read chapters from The New Hobbit, as they would call it.
Yeah, and so then they at these meetings, they would talk about all sorts of things. I mean, before this group was called the Inklings, I think they started calling the Inklings in the 30s. Before it was called the Inklings, they would meet a little less formally and do the same type of thing. And I think we noted a couple episodes ago that it was sort of out of some of these meetings with other professors who were Christian, that really Lewis was kind of harangued into first theism and then the idea of being a Christian.
Yeah, so I think I would just to condense simply for people like a bunch of stuff you just laid out there. There are some what we would say criteria or rules around being an Inkling. So by the time it's actually the Inklings, Lewis is a Christian. And so one of the things is everybody in the group is Christian, not just theist.
But broadly conceived, right?
Broadly conceived.
Yeah. Broadly conceived. Orthodoxy is perhaps not a qualification.
Yeah, that's correct.
But at least some sort of personal confession of Christian faith is needed. And then you have to be a writer. You have to write things. Was very sort of part of the ink part of this is that ink really does have to be spilled to be in the conversation. Now, not everybody was presenting every week, but it was one of these things. And then the other interesting part of this is it's not a random group of people, but it's sort of by invite of Lewis. So everybody who's in this is a friend of Lewis specifically, and then each other sort of outside of that. So he's the nucleus of this.
Yeah, he group. Was sort of the society, and then he invited in other people into the orbit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think sometimes out of the orbit.
Yeah, and just some of the accounts of personality clash in and outside of the group is also funny, right? It's not always chummy. I forget who it was. Maybe it was Charles Williams at one point got sick of Tolkien taking over every meeting with chapters from the New Hobbit, and a member could veto a reading. He would veto Tolkien reading chapters from the New Hobbit.
Yeah.
Which was...
Did they follow Robert's rules, or how do they do this?
I don't know. Right, yeah. Is it pirate democracy? Yeah. I have no clue.
And wasn't it Charles... I always say this wrong. Adam can correct me. Charles Williams was the theophysite. Is that how you say it, Adam?
Theosophist.
Theosophist, thank you.
Yeah.
Which is just a weird sort of... melding of some Christian theological principles and occult?
It's very, to use a sort of historic term, Gnostic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's, they will use terminology, Christian terminology, but it's informed by a different theology. You get this special insight, special divine revelation, not in a Pentecostal sense, but, God has revealed something universal to you privately and specially.
Yeah, Williams is also not a professor. He was he worked for OUP, Oxford University Press.
Yeah, and he would lecture occasionally, though. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, wasn't he one of, like, the main editors for Oxford University Press?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and so he... that was his sort of relationship, is that he was in Oxford. He made friends with these other writers. His theology is sort of interesting because he writes sort of extensively on participation in Christ and participation with the Trinity, which is a hot topic today in a lot of circles. But I rarely see him referenced by those people who are sort of coming up with theories of participation, though he... as far as theological writings, that is a lot of what he wrote. So
it's kind of fun. I'm not sure. Back pre-COVID, you could go to Oxford and you could actually go to the Eagle and Child and you could sit in the booth where the Inklings sat and order some fish and chips and mushy peas. And
probably you couldn't smoke cigarettes in there anymore, huh?
That's been pulled from an old tap, where they're buried over there. Those pubs. Did you ever notice how they would fill the pints up to the very top, or if it was more than a pint, there was a line, and they get real persnickety if it's not exactly one pint.
It's all measured by the government, and they come in and do the measurements, and even sort of when you get a shot poured in England, it's comes out of a dispenser because the government very much controls like the amount that is supposed to be in a shot. So there's not like heavy pours in England.
Is that like sobriety laws or is that like consumer protection law?
I think
law?
It's consumer protection. Don't you? Yeah, I think it's consumer protection.
That's the way what I heard anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The British pub experience is a thing. Eagle and Child was, at least when I was there, Scott, I don't know if it was the same when you were there. It was just a few years after, right? It was quite a place people would go to. And the pubs closed down early in Oxford, but Eagle and Child, they would stay open. But they were required by law to close down, but they would just shut the door. And there was there wasn't a secret knock, but there was something that you had to do. I never learned it. I just went with people who knew it. To get in after hours, but people still hang out. They don't have obviously the Inklings, but it's not uncommon to see like Dermot McCulloch, the professor of church history, and some of his friends hanging out there, talking about politics or theology or what have you.
Drinking. I usually went to the Bear, which is the one behind Christ Church with the really low ceilings.
Oh yeah, That thing's been around since like the 13th century, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
That's why the ceiling's so low, because people were shorter back then, apparently.
I didn't have the pleasure of going to Oxford, but you kind of get the picture from here that it's like, oh, it's just romanticized going to a bar. Like, no, it is different. Like, the pubs in England are not the same.
So they kind of have both. Like, it's kind of funny. You can wander into what would be something more akin, even though it's probably still somebody's local pub, kind of more on the working class side of town in Oxford. You wander in, it resemble a little bit more a sports bar. I'd say there'll be TVs and soccer games on and stuff like that. But in downtown, like the pubs in downtown Oxford, like the one that they showed in the Lewis movie, which is the White Horse Inn next to the Big Blackwell's Bookshop, the Bear, the Eagle and Child, and I'm sure I'm missing a bunch. They are more sort of like the kind of pubs that you see in a BBC movie.
Yeah. I mean, even in Nottingham, like I went to 4 or 5 that have this vibe, right? And it's almost scientific how they have just enough light in them. Like, they're all like this particular type of dimly lit, but not so dimly you want to get out of there, right? Yeah. The tables are sticky, but not dirty.
Not too sticky.
Yeah, there's, I mean, it's weird. If you go to, Callan's in Sugarloaf, right? You touch the table and you're like, oh, that's gross.
You're
that's
like,
sticky.
Now don't eat anything.
Yeah, but you touch the table with these and you go, that's the right kind of sticky? Like, what?
Well, we should get back to the Inklings, but the other thing I always, when I first got there, thought was strange is you'd go in and you'd order food, and it's, that too is a little bit different experience because...
No server.
Yeah, you go up to the bar and you order, and they kind of, it's kind of cool, the publicans, right? That's what they call them? Yeah. Kind of keep an eye on for where you sit, and then either it comes to the bar or they bring it out to where you sit. But the food almost always is cooked like downstairs in a kitchen that you'll never see and comes up on a dumbwaiter. And so that's kind of weird. That was always kind of weird. Like, you'd order food and you're wondering for like, where is the cooking going to happen? And I think it happens
there's
moles down.
That work underneath the building.
Yeah.
It's like the Bodleian Library there.
Yeah.
There are books on shelves that, for reference, but by and large, and there's millions of volumes underneath the street. Yep. But you have to plan ahead, like a couple of days ahead.
Yeah, you got to ask
what you're going to call up and read that day.
And you even have to designate to which like reading room you need it delivered.
Yeah. The joke is there's a bunch of like half mole, half human. I don't know what that would be.
Yeah,
mole man.
And the books are there's like conveyor system all under the city to deliver the books.
It's pretty awesome.
I mean,
that's you very take cool. You take this weird oath before you
that you won't steal
study.
Books.
No, that you won't bring candles.
Pen, you won't bring anything.
A candle.
Yeah.
Like you have a sacred oath that you won't bring a candle into the stacks.
Well, and those beautiful signs all around the library that just say "Silence, please."
Yeah. It's a different experience.
Very different world.
Yeah.
We should probably get back to the Inklings.
Well,
yeah?
I mean, I guess in stark contrast, right? If these are the formal rules of your office, the library, the university, right? In order to get sort of down to the nitty gritty, you're going to have to go to somewhere where you can spill beer.
Yeah.
You can't begin arguing in the library. There's shush, be quiet signs. You can't have a candle in there.
Yeah.
And you're certainly not doing any drinking.
Yeah. I bet they couldn't even smoke their pipes in the library.
I mean, no. Yeah. That would, now you can't smoke them anywhere. But
that's true. They probably can't smoke them in their offices anymore.
So the core idea behind this group is sort of friendship, camaraderie, but then also like an actual space to try your writing before it goes into publication, right?
Maybe think of it as like a writer's working group, like not collaborative, right? Because they're not helping you write, but critical.
Is it a collective? A collective?
No. No, it's not a collective. Critical of your work. So there's a quote from Warney. I don't remember, but it's like, he said something like, don't think of this as a mutual admiration society. Mm-hmm. He's like, praise was heaped heavily when writing was good, but criticism was heaped even more heavily when writing was bad or even not so good. And so this is a group of people who think their product are words, right? And they come together to make sure that their product is as good as it can be, which means that every time they write something down and then share it, you're expecting that other people that are as good at this or better than you are going to, if it's good, probably say, yeah, that's good.
They're going to have a comment.
And if it's bad, they're going to rip into you. And you get together twice a week like clockwork to endure this punishment because you want what you do to be better. Now, I'd say it's a friendship group, but it's a friendship group in this sense that there's a way in which you're going to only accept that type of really candid criticism from a friend who has that common interest with you and is as invested in making their writing as good as it can be as you are. You wouldn't accept that kind of hard criticism from somebody who has no ability in writing themselves, who is coming in from the outside. And we don't do this so much anymore. We tried to do a group like this with 15, 17 for years and kind of did and kind of didn't. But there's a similarity in it, like handing over, you know, something that you worked a really long time on to Adam and saying, tear it up, make it better. Let me know where it's good. Let me know what's bad.
Yeah, I would say, you know, as best as I can, I do this when I write for the 1517 blog. We have two great editors over at the blog, but before those editors ever even see or touch,
I have three or four
friends reading my work and giving criticism and feedback, which then those revisions make it to, you know, editorial.
It was the same thing for them. I mean, anything Lewis published would then eventually go to an official editor.
Right.
Right. So, but there's a difference in sharing something with your friends and letting them give you, I mean, my friends could tell me, oh, this is crap. This is horrible. It's the worst thing you ever wrote. And I'd be like, oh yeah, you're probably right. It is, you know, or try to fix it. But if some editor that I didn't know, like, with a publisher did that, oh, this is crap. This is horrible. I probably wouldn't believe him. I'd probably just farm it out to another publisher.
Even when you know the editor, it's not an insult to have a particular type of person's feedback make sense to you, right? Or no. Be constructive in a way it's not like an editor's feedback can't be valuable, but that be constructive in a way that you resonate with and can return the favor.
Yeah, I mean, one of the people I always used to have read like Being Dad is a great example. First person to go through the original copy of Being Dad was Jeff Mallinson. And I'll kind of never forget it. He was at Concordia, still up in the theology department at that time. Went up and sat in his office. Like, well, what do you think? He goes, well, I think if you start the book the way you started it, nobody's ever going to read this book. Mm. And I thought, what do you mean by that? You
know, I wanted you to say it was good.
Yeah. And, but he didn't, he gave me the honest feedback on it. And he said, you have to start this book by hooking them because the rest of the book, he said, is actually pretty good and can be made better, but it's pretty good. But the way you wrote the first chapter, nobody's going to get past the first chapter. Mm. So he said, you need to write a hook in there. So I wrote a hook. And it's, you know, been received pretty well ever since. But I credit Jeff for a lot of that. But that was a friendship conversation. After that, had some other people read it. After that, it went through several editings, you know, mm-hmm. like official editings. And this was sort of what this group, you know, this group served that purpose for these people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I think there is. One of the problems with this today for some people would be the exclusivity of the group. Exclusive, like, hey, only my 5-6 friends are a part of this, would be, I think, viewed as very cruel by many people today.
Yeah, only the people I pick.
And actually, especially by Christians, that would be characterized as unkindness, right? Yeah. Don't other people's opinions matter?
But it was a free association, right? So, I mean, I wonder if, were there people who wanted to get in who were denied?
Dorothy Sayers.
Or were there, oh yeah, well, was she denied because she was a, she had an X and an X chromosome.
Yes.
And also happened to identify as a woman.
Yes. Wow, you've been at that university too long. That's my official conclusion.
I think you're right. I don't disagree.
Well, I mean, let's just think of some of those categories. So, yes, Dorothy Sayers, like, for a woman, was not allowed because women weren't allowed in the group. Now, that today, that would be cruel, right?
That'd be unheard of. Literally, like, the group's got to be shut down. The people have to be camped.
This other category of non-Christians not being allowed, too. How close-minded of you to say that a non-Christian couldn't contribute to this?
Although they did let a theosophist in, so, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
he's broadly conceived Christianity.
Yeah,
okay. he did believe he needed union with Christ. Now, what that means is interesting, but Christ is still central to his theology.
By the way, have you ever tried to read any Charles Williams?
Yeah,
I did years ago, Esoteric. And I stopped. I just put it down and walked away.
It's an oof.
In many ways, funny enough, it's almost the opposite of Lewis writing, like we were talking about last episode, where like. You know, Lewis brought theology down to this lay level. Williams, like, really does theology as like a speculative science again.
Yeah,
it's very esoteric.
Which is maybe to another point is that you have kind of all styles in here. I mean, I think one of the things to always point out is the two names that people will probably recognize in this group are going to be J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. Now, you recognize those names because they're, you know, they've sold, I think it's fair to say, millions of books each.
Their literary fiction is some of the most popular in the world.
Yeah, their literary fiction is some of the most popular in the world. Stylistically, completely different. Especially Tolkien used to really, in Inklings meetings, ride Lewis hard about how obvious his allegories were in especially the Chronicles of Narnia, but then even would give him, I think these days we'd say, would give him crap to the extreme level for writing the Space Trilogy, which was kind of like, I think one of Lewis's or Tolkien's criticism was it was sort of like a redo of Narnia in space, which I don't think that's not an accurate criticism at all, but I've heard him say that, and I think he's just talking about like there's some very one-to-one examples in the Space Trilogy. You very much like in Perelandra, you very much know who the devil is, and you very much know who Eve is. It's like not hard to tell. There's that. The ransom character, you know, is consistent through all of those, as are sort of like the children in the Narnia Chronicles, and so. And I think Lewis would, lesser so, but would criticize Tolkien for by saying, I wonder if people will even get the point.
There is a tension between the two, especially as we, to talk about a topic from last episode where we talked about lay people doing theology, where Tolkien really believed that theology belonged to theologians and to
the church.
And to the church and his and priests, right? And for those trained and authorized by the church, that's part of his Catholicism that is organic and real and sort of actually, you know, if you're going to be a Catholic, good to see that you're consistent, right?
Right.
I mean, today I run into any number of Catholics who bend the rules, especially around sacraments like marriage, and go, it doesn't matter. I had a Christian marriage.
You know? Not Tolkien.
Tolkien was very consistent about the church has the authority to teach. It has to authorize people into that position.
Yeah.
And Lewis was going outside of that mold. And even in so doing, Tolkien was careful not to be teaching theology in his works. I think he would say that, you know, inside of The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, it wasn't analogy and it wasn't metaphor. It's a shadowy picture of a general story that God has put into the creation. Now, that story becomes very not general in Christ, but apart from Christ and apart from the death and resurrection of Christ, it's a general story that's in everything, and it's the power that gives stories their ability to move, communicate, and so that's the project he was a part of. But he would say that that's a product of every good story, not just his.
Right. Well, in his... although when you read on his great essay on fairy stories, you know, he very much says in that essay that the point of writing any fairy story is to at least allude to the fact that there was one of these stories that was actually true. It actually happened, and that it is the fairy story that permeates all things, because it's the fairy story that matters to all people. And so there is a sense in which he very much in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings is trying to connect people to the story of Christ and him crucified for the forgiveness of sins and the resurrection of the body unto everlasting life. But at the same time, to just write it as a fairy story, you know, that sort of has those hints of it in more of a hint. Whereas Lewis is actually, I mean, think of The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. He's actually writing the story of the death and resurrection of Christ very clearly, through and redemption of all people, through the story of the children in Aslan.
Yeah, everything I've read or heard about Lewis and Tolkien's relationship is often describes those two as having two very different personalities.
Yes,
and not asking for any sort of psychohistory here or anything, but I wonder, is this a professional disagreement, do you think, between Lewis and Tolkien on how it should be done, or is it more just their personality, perhaps shaped in part by, you know, Tolkien's Catholicism and Lewis's, if you will, evangelicalism?
I think that's fair of Lewis, to say evangelicalism of Lewis, if you think of it sort of in the classic sense, and not sort of the modern church growthy movement sense.
Yeah, if we're talking about like gospel proclamation forward theology, I think that classifies, and very much so, that's not the theological project that Tolkien's up to.
So there are accounts, very very vivid accounts of Tolkien and Lewis actually getting very angry with one another in their personal lives, to the point where I think Caleb has read on this a little more recently than I have, but I believe there was like a 3-year period where they didn't speak.
I mean, I haven't read or heard of that. I know that there were tensions around not just that writing style, but in fact, the prevalence and inclusion of certain people in the Inklings meetings.
Right. Disagreements about who would be there, Charles Williams.
Charles Williams' friendship with Lewis made Tolkien weary.
Well, and I think that was the jumping off point to them not speaking for a while. And I think, much like me, Tolkien's claim was that he wasn't a Christian.
and Tolkien was worried that it would re-spark this interest in the occult in Lewis and sort of drive him away to speculating about.
And had re-sparked it in him, as a matter of fact.
Now, what's funny is the account that I listened to was that, in fact, though Tolkien had these objections about how close Lewis and Williams had been getting, an especially sort of personal theological relationship between those two, that Williams and Tolkien had a great personal relationship outside of the Lewis problem, too, that he actually considered him a really good friend and would, you know, outside of the Inklings, get meals with him and things like that. But that for it was these sort of...
I don't doubt that, because one of, you know, some of the accounts that you get from biographers is that the frustration between Tolkien and Lewis really came from the fact that Tolkien thought he should have sort of completed his conversion to Christianity by becoming a Roman Catholic. Mm. And that when he didn't, this was a very sore subject for the two of them, because Tolkien was really instrumental in bringing Lewis to Christianity. Really instrumental in that move. And then that's always hard, because I think it's kind of understandable that Lewis, when he became a Christian, migrated to the type of Christianity he had known as a child. In fact, when he talks about even his Anglican priest as a child, there's not a lot of negativity there. It's not, he believes that the priest was earnest in his belief and that taught him Orthodox Christianity, and not some sort of mealy-mouth substitute for it. It's just that Lewis didn't believe it, and he doesn't blame the priest for that. He actually very clearly blames himself for that and sort of his own arrogance. When he talks about, when Lewis talks about his schooling, he says, my schooling had the effect of making me arrogant. Which is also what he thinks led to some of the issues that he had with his father, and the regret that he had over not really have kind of fixing the relationship with his father before his father's death. And that, so it was natural for Lewis to go to the church of his familiarity, but because Tolkien was so involved with his conversion, I think Tolkien remained disappointed that he didn't kind of, quote unquote, go all the way into Roman Catholicism, point attention. And then you lead to that sort of Lewis in a, again, very evangelical way in all of his books, doing a redemption forward narrative, Christ and him crucified for the forgiveness of sins forward narrative. And, I don't know. It's an interesting story.
I kind of wonder about a little bit of, you know, convert syndrome. You guys know right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
And we experience this a lot, and I don't want to.
Tolkien is like, yeah, good for you, Lewis. You discovered.
I don't want to, like, you know, insult listeners who have, you know, come to Lutheranism or something. But oftentimes, when somebody comes from one tradition into another one, their enthusiasm, not like enthusiast theology, but their enthusiasm is so great, and they're so worked up about this great newfound thing that they have a hard time tempering anything, right? And they can also be moved a lot. Sometimes you'll run into people who, I started off a Pentecostal, then I became an evangelical, then I was confessionally reformed for a while, and now I'm a Lutheran, or whatever order you want to put those in. Those people, when they move with a lot of emotion and buy-in to those things, sometimes you kind of want to say, hey, you need to slow down before your enthusiasm maybe hops you to the next thing, right? And you can see that maybe with Tolkien here is that, hey, you need to be careful before your enthusiasm hops you to this non-Orthodox sort of overly spiritual Christianity, because
I look out for that guy, Charles Williams, because he might help.
And because he might push you there, right? Okay. And I think you kind of sometimes see that, you know, a well-meaning excitement for, you know, the gospel can sort of turn people to keep looking for that excitement when it starts to fade.
Yeah. I think the one thing, if takeaway for me, for the listeners from this show, is that whether you hear the conflict or you hear the camaraderie, it was a true fellowship in the sort of the best sense of the word. When you come together for fellowship, you know, I don't think it's a good idea to always just look to coming to sort of, as Warney said, a mutual admiration society. It's good to come together with actual friends, and actual friendships are going to be dangerous, because not only will dangerous ideas be discussed, but sort of dangerous conversations that might offend your sensibilities will be had, and that's a good thing. Adam and I, when we were at Concordia as youngsters, had a professor named Bob Dargitz. And I remember, one of the things I remember about Dargitz were not just his Old Testament class and big Old Testament paper, but the fact that if you were ever outside of his class having a conversation about things that carried over from another class or from his class or whatever, he'd always walk by and he'd be like, oh, that's what I love to see, iron sharpening iron. And this was, you know, and it was kind of goofy, but at the same time, you're like, yeah, that's what's happening here. And that's what the meeting of the Inklings was. And I think think about the idea of the Fellowship of the Rings and the Lord of the Rings. These, even in those stories, it's not people that just always got along all the time. You know, the idea was that this fellowship of sort of diverse characters who, you know, shouldn't have gotten along, came together to save the world. And not like the Inklings saved the world, but it was a true fellowship in that way. Diverse people for Oxford at the time, with diverse ideas for Oxford at the time, came together to discuss what they were working on as they were trying to impact the world through their craft, which was writing. And, you know, we need more of that, not less of that.
If ideas matter, how could you get along with no disagreements with your friends ever?
I have no idea.
Be a very dangerous.
I mean, I'm pissed off at Adam all the time, so.
What did I do?
By the way, I was just going to say, there's a couple books I read on this. It was about 3 years ago. The one, I just pulled it off the shelf, that I really like and that I would totally recommend to people is by Philip and Carol Zaleski. It's called The Fellowship. It's subtitled The Literary Lives of the Inklings, J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, Owen Barfield, and Charles Williams. I would totally recommend it. It's thick, but it's broken into chapters, not just sort of by the Inklings themselves, but by the various characters. So you can, it's a book you could put down and pick up.
This might be an okay time to mention that The Thinking Fellows has been dethroned in the Apple Podcast number one episode on C.S. Lewis, probably rightfully dethroned by a new podcast that has come out on C.S. Lewis and the Inklings by Alistair McGrath. He's the host or co-host of that show. And so McGrath has dethroned our number one episode. But those are probably worth listening to. McGrath is if you want to continue this topic, he's a very well-respected professor, and he's definitely put in the work and the publications on this subject matter.
I mean, the
you have two bios on Lewis,
yeah,
right?
I would say the biographies of Lewis that I keep on my shelf are the McGrath.
Right. So so you might find that, and yeah, totally give that a listen. He did
also do, was Adam's advisor at Oxford. No, Adam? Yes?
He was the principal at the college I was at, and my office was directly underneath his. And so I ate dinner with him. He was a great guy. He reminded me of Mr. Bean a bit, his mannerisms, but man,
a lot
he's
of them
brilliant.
Remind you.
There's a bunch of Mr. Beans running around Oxford. So
Americans are like, all British people are the same. It's horrible. Horrible.
Listen to this. I just found in that biography, I found something that I underlined, which is Tolkien saying and sort of some of his motivation for writing The Lord of the Rings. I'm going to try to read it, but it's sort of in classic academic British writing. So there's in dashes and parenthetical remarks and everything laced within this. So I'm going to do my best.
It's a sentence and a thought.
It's a sentence and a thought all at one time. And it's a rather long sentence. I was from early days grieved by the poverty of my own beloved country. It has no stories of its own, bound up with its tongue and soil, not of the quality that I sought and found as an ingredient in the legends of other lands. Then he says, do not laugh. But once upon a time, I had a mind to make a body of more or less connected legend, ranging from the large and cosmogonic, to the level of romantic fairy story, which I could dedicate simply to England, to my country. That's kind of neat.
That's Tolkien.
That's Tolkien, yeah. That's kind of neat.
That's great. Yeah, and next... Oh, go ahead.
Are we out of time?
No, you can say something.
We've talked quite a bit last 10 minutes or so about the differences in their personalities, and I keep coming back only... I have you to blame for this, Scott, to this Weight of Glory sermon that he preached, where there's a great line from Lewis I think kind of can illustrate what drives Lewis as opposed to what drives Tolkien. Tolkien's a dignified, stately kind of figure, it seems. And for Lewis, he's would we use the term evangelical? And he's also an evangelist, I think you could argue, in that he, in Weight of Glory, ends up by, after he's talked about maybe we could say the immortality of the soul or something that we all have, and Christians are going to realize it in a positive way. And he says, but you can think too much about this, but the thing that really should drive you or burden you is that as Lewis puts it, it's hardly possible for the Christian to think too often or too deeply about the soul of their neighbor. The load or weight or burden of my neighbor's glory should be laid daily on my back, a load so heavy that only humility can carry it, and the backs of the proud will be broken.
A load so heavy, only humility can carry it.
Yeah.
That's great.
And I mean, I'm no Lewis scholar, and certainly have not read in as nearly as much as you've read on Lewis and his bio and so on and so forth. But it seems to me that this is what drives, this is why he writes theology for the common person.
Yep.
'Cause he does have that burden, that I think anybody who believes that Jesus' death wasn't just for the elect or for those who are members of a church or whatever, but for the whole world.
And honestly, it's the Inklings that inspired the genesis of the Thinking Fellows podcast, because the idea was to come together with friends and colleagues and discuss ideas, books, words, things we were working on, things other people had worked on, classical works of theology and philosophy and history and apologetics. And we've been doing it now for 6 years. I found another line from this book that kind of reminds me of why we wanted to do this podcast. If the stated purpose of the Inklings was to read and critique one another's writings, the implicit but universally acknowledged aim was to revel in one another's talk. Often gatherings had no readings at all, only loud, boisterous back and forth on a vast range of topics. Among the Inklings, pen and tongue held equal sway.
That's great. Well, thank you for joining us on this episode. Next episode of the Thinking Fellows, we will do a full episode on Tolkien, give a little bit of his biography, talk about The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, and also some of these smaller published essays that have to do with literature, literary criticism, or even poetry. So we will catch you next week. Thank you for listening. Bye.